And you know where we all wound up, don't you? Phoenix, Arizona. And I would say the drunkest, dirtiest, filthiest milkman you've ever seen from a Phoenix bar called Gordon. And Gordon came down and got me. Finally, he cleaned me up and sobered me up to the best of his ability. And finally, when I got lucid enough, I got Gordon in the corner. And I looked this skinny, scrawny guy right in the eye, and I said, "Gordon, what keeps you sober?" Well, this little skinny, scrawny guy looked me right square back in the eye, and he said, "Cliff, you're not going to like it, but I'm going to give it to you straight. I am staying sober because I have placed my drinking problem in the hands of a power greater than myself that I call God. And by working and practicing this program, I am increasing my conscious contact with this God and this power and getting direction for everything that I do." He said, "Cliff, my whole life has changed, and I have found a wonderful way to live." Gordon had given me the most unacceptable answer he could have ever given me. And I was the most disappointed guy in the United States, believe me. But Gordon didn't argue. That night he put me on one of these huge trucks that ply from Phoenix to Los Angeles filled with freight. Now somewhere between Phoenix and Los Angeles, in the middle of the night, for the first time in my life, I hit bottom. You think all the things I'd gone before. The indictment of the doctor. I should have hit bottom, but I hadn't. You new people are going to hear that expression quite often. You gotta hit bottom. Well, you say, "Well, what is it?" We can only tell you how it happens to us. I've noticed you modern AAs have raised the bottom that alcoholics have to hit. And I think it's wonderful, the way you've improved your techniques of identification. That's one of the most gratifying changes in AA. The young people that are coming in, the people that haven't had to go the complete route, who can see this thing within themselves far beyond going to the ends of the railroad. And I'm quite sure a lot of these we have people coming in at 16 and 17 and are staying sober. And I think they hit this probably by stages, by osmosis, by association. But with me, I hit it with a real big clunk. Here's the way it was with me. I'm riding in this truck. I got the world's worst hangover. The remorses were the worst they had ever been. The guilt. And all of a sudden, it was as if somebody had turned a light on inside me. And I saw Cliff Walker as he really was, for the first time in my life. I saw my drinking for what it was. Stripped of all the romance and the glamour and the things that I had attached to it. Always, to me, drinking was manly. Right, in the old days, you know, you carried the flask on the hip and the silent pictures, even then. The He-Man was the guy that could drink everybody under the table. But all this was stripped away, and I saw my drinking for what it was, in all its sordidness. And I saw that I was not only destroying my life, but the lives of the people I loved the most. And suddenly I sensed that I had become a complete and total failure at the business of living. I couldn't possibly stand here today and tell you the depths to which I sank, the despair, the hopelessness, for the first time in my life, I almost committed suicide. I just almost jumped out of the truck. I felt so hopeless and so helpless. Now, in AA, we call that hitting bottom. I think the religionists call it surrender. The psychiatrists call it deflation in depth. But to me, it's all the same thing. All the same thing. Whatever you call it. Because this was the start for my recovery. Because right at there, I made a decision that became the turning point in my life. You know what it was? I knew I couldn't come to believe in God and all these things. But I thought of Gordon staying sober in Phoenix, and I thought of Frank and Mort staying sober in Los Angeles. And I thought, surely there must be a way out for me. I can't commit suicide. My kids would think I was a coward. I wonder if they will take me back. And then I made this decision. I'm going back to Los Angeles. I'm going back to AA. And I'll do anything in God's green earth they ask me to do, whether I like it or not. You see, I'd reached an attitude of mind that all terminally sick people reach. A cancer patient, a tubercular, anybody that knows they're dying, become very open-minded, don't they? And they'll grasp at anything to get well. That's the way I was. I'd run out of choices. I only had alternatives. One road, oblivion. The other way, a chance. So I came back to Los Angeles. And I called them up and asked them if they'd take me back. And they said yes. But you know, this thing was entirely different. I picked up the big book and I started to read, and it was entirely different. I had read it before, I thought, but it meant nothing to me. But now I began to get the healing message that's in the big book. The language of the heart, the language of love. You know what AA has given to the field of alcoholism? This transmission line of one drunk talking to another. However, Dr. Bob and Bill learned the hard way that this only comes about when the sponsor and the sponsee not only realize their great need of each other, not only need each other, but have a deep realization of that need. It doesn't work if only one person needs it and recognizes it. You know Bill, he went 6 months out. He was preaching and teaching and telling these people about this spiritual experience, and he got nobody sober. But when he went to Akron on a business deal and had a failure, he wanted to drink, and he knew he had to talk to another drunk. So he found Bob, and he described himself and got Dr. Bob sober. But more important, and just as important, Dr. Bob kept Bill sober. And that was when AA started, the chain reaction that is AA today. And I don't think it will never change. Just one drunk talking to another. But when I read this book now, I'm seeing myself on every page. When they describe the alcoholic, they're describing me. I'm sure that somehow they've been checking my mail or talking to Dorothy. How could these guys know so much about me? When they describe an alcoholic and say he's different than the normal heavy steady drinker or heavy steady drinker, that's me. Somewhere along the line, he loses control. Upon taking a drink, drinks more than he originally intended. One drink too many, 100 not enough. These are all hitting me. And as he progresses in the disease, he changes his personality. The drinking personality very little resembles this sober personality. And they become this true Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Boy, that hit me right in the eye. I thought, my God, I know they're talking to Dorothy. Dorothy used to say, Cliff, I just don't understand. She said, when you're sober, you're a good husband, a good father, you're kind and gentle. You're a fine man. But when you take one drink, it changes your personality. You get sarcastic and vile. And you shut yourself off from us. And I guess I used to be pretty unlovely in my cups. Because Dorothy, who never swears, had a very descriptive pet name for me. You know what it was? In my cups, she used to call me a revolving bastard. And when I was get sober, I'd say, "Honey, why a revolving one?" She said, "Well, any angle I look at you from, you're still a bastard." I could probably give you 45,000 reasons why she could have for calling me that. But what is happening? They say, and other things, almost knocking me down here with these truths. That the alcoholic quite often develops a positive genius for getting drunk at the wrong time. That's me. Hiding bottles. I was sure they'd been around our house. And they talked about hiding bottles. But boy, that was a real contest around the Walker household. I have a smart wife. And it took an awful lot of thinking and planning and ingenuity to get bottles into the house. If I'd have spent as much time on my job as I did at planning that, I'd have been president. It said that the alcoholic, over any period of time, gets progressively worse, never better. And I looked at my past life, and that had been true. At times I thought I was controlling. At times I thought I had it whipped. But over any period of time, it got progressively worse. And then a time arrives where we know that something is desperately wrong and we look for this way out. And there's no way out. We go to our doctor, our preacher, our friends, and they can't help us. And then we begin that endless cycle of sanitariums, jails, finally the madhouses or the morgues. I think that could be the thumbnail case history of any alcoholic that ever lived or died. But it certainly described me. But more important, I am beginning to see through their eyes and their experience that I am an alcoholic. There isn't anybody else on God's green earth that could have sold me that idea except a recovered alcoholic. Nobody. And they began to teach me things that were very important. You know, one of the most demoralizing things to me about my drinking, when I hit that period of where I realized that something was desperately wrong, and I knew I couldn't drink, when I tried to, I couldn't stop. The thing in the bottle had me licked. I always prided myself on when I made up my mind to do something, that I had an implacable will. I could do it. But this bottle, no. It had me licked. You know, it was a blow to my masculine pride that a 95-pound blonde, soaking wet, could take a couple of martinis and I couldn't. Well, they told me in the book why I couldn't quit. And to me, it was kind of the key to opening the door. Said in there that certain type drinkers, compulsive or obsessive, if they don't take a drink, they react pretty normally. But if they should ever take a drink into their system, whether they've been dry 1 year or 50 years, when this drink goes into the body, it sets up a phenomena of craving beyond their mental and physical control. Now it said, so far, and I'm sure this is true today, that medical science, as great as they are, have not yet designed or found a antibiotic, a wonder drug, or anything else, or any other chemical that will remove this physical difference that we have in our body. I mean, this is physical and it's mental. But the physical is always there, and there is nothing yet that will change our body so that this compulsion will not be triggered on taking a drink. Well, I'll tell you what that meant to me. It was very important. And that is that the solution to my problem did not center in the body. It centered in the mind. like thousands upon thousands of other alcoholics. I had to find a way of living that did not demand the first drink. That, I think, is what AA is all about. I didn't say a way of life or an ideology or a philosophy. I said a way of living. I don't think it was by chance that our recovery program was called 12 Steps. They weren't called 12 philosophies or 12 ideologies. They're 12 steps. Steps means action, don't it? Not thought, action. Find a way of living that does not demand the first drink. You know, I went to Frank and Mort, and I told them my problem, and they knew it, about God and my hatred and my antagonism. And I told them I couldn't possibly take the second and third step honestly. I mean, it was just beyond my capacity. And Frank, my tough sponsor, was wondrously wise for just his few years in AA. He said, "Cliff, don't worry about the God business. That'll come." He says, "Use us for your higher power if you want." And at that time, AAs have used it now for the last 25 years, the principle of substitution. The group, their sponsor, anything, just something bigger than they are, and that's what I did. I had made one concession, that such a power existed because I had seen it operate in Mort and Frank and Gordon. But Frank said, "Cliff, you go ahead with the action part of the program." He said, "You've got an awful dirty house. I think it's going to take you 100 years to get that house clean if you start today. And the good place to start is the fourth step, that inventory." Then he admonished me. He said, "Cliff, if you try to put any of these steps into action, before you take it, make up your mind to be as fearless, as honest, and as painstaking as you can. Remember, you're dealing with the most important thing in life, your own health, your own welfare." So, with that admonishment, I went to work. I was sure that I could never, never have help from God. If you knew what I'd said about him, how I cursed him, and I debated against him, you'd know my feelings. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to take these other steps about twice as good as anybody else. And I went to ridiculous extreme. When I took an inventory, believe me, I took an inventory. I think I wrote on every piece of paper in the house and all over the walls. But a very funny thing happened when I finished it and read it. It was very revealing. I found out that there was a lot more wrong with me than just drinking. It was amazing. I honestly didn't know all this. My God, I resented everything. Institutions, things, people, my God, I was just filled with resentment and hatred and anxiety and fears. My God, and it was all written down there where I could see it. And you know, I began to learn one of the great lessons of my AA life. I don't know how you were, but when I was at the worst in my drinking, being a very proud sort of a guy, I had to justify it. I mean, I think it's a human trait, but I had to justify these things I was doing. They were too horrible not to justify it. And I always justified it by the conditions that brought it about. I didn't get my education because I broke my leg when I was a freshman at USC and lost my scholarship. That's why all these other guys are going by me. They got their sheepskin. My boss would only understand me. What a genius I am. How conscientious I am. Or I might say, if I only had a different wife that understood me. I don't tell Dorothy that way. Or if somebody would leave me $1 million. God, I'd be all right. Pay off my bills and I'd have no problem. I'd have no reason to drink. The conditions were only different. Well, I'm beginning to learn that the conditions are always the same. You all know that. Everybody has problems, don't they? Everybody has business failure. Everybody has bereavements and tragedies. That is growing up in this world of ours. They don't go out and destroy their lives because of the conditions. No. What I'm learning, beginning to learn now, that this program can change me to meet the conditions, whatever they happen to be. And what the kind of sobriety I am striving for is where I can stay sober, live to good purpose, be reasonably happy under any and all conditions. And I know this program will make that possible. Of course, at that time I didn't realize that, but I'm beginning to learn it. And I must admit, the way I'm working the 12 steps is by rote. I still don't like them a damn bit better than I did before. It's a do-or-die basis with me. It's repulsive to me, but Frank says to do it, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to show him I'll do it better than anybody else. And so I was taking everything by rote. Probably like an old maid would take Lydia Pinkham's compound. She didn't understand it, didn't know what was in it, but she hoped something would happen. That's the way I was. Well, that didn't matter. I'm a dry speaker. I usually drink about 3 of these. I'm going along. I don't know how much time passes, but finally, I call up Frank, and I said, Frank, I'm in trouble. He said, what's the matter, Cliff? I said, you know, since I come back from Phoenix, I've done everything you've asked me to do, haven't I? He said, yes, Cliff, you've done a real good job. I said, but I've got something I can't handle. He said, what's the matter? I said, well, I've been trying to take these amend steps. For you new people, the founders felt that to get along with people, we would have to right our wrongs of the past. And so we make amends to the people we harm. And I said, Frank, I've written letters and gone to people that I felt that I've harmed. Nothing's really happened, but nothing bad's happened. But I said, in the book, it said when you are making amends, you shouldn't forget your creditors. Instead, you should go to them and tell them what happened. Now, Frank, you know I can't do that. My God, when I went to Phoenix with a milk truck, I took about $700 or $800 of the company's money. But the bonding company had to pay it back. I'd borrowed $100 on a $50 Ford that was wrecked. I owed grocery bills. I owed every stick of furniture in our house had been bought on the dollar down and so much a month plan. I just owed everybody. I said, Frank, I think with such a weight of debt, I better go to South America and start all over. Well, Frank says, well, go ahead, Cliff. Go on. You go to South America. But I want to tell you something. When you get to South America and you get off the boat, at the end of the gangplank, the first guy you're going to run into is Cliff Walker. You've been running away from that guy for years. Don't you think it's time now to face up to him? He said, when you come back from Phoenix, you said you would do anything. You would go to any lengths to stay sober. You said you'd jump off the pier with your clothes on if I asked you to. Did you mean it? I said, yes, Frank, I did. He said, will you then do what I ask you to do? And I said, I'll try. He said, you get up tomorrow morning, go down to the bonding company and tell them what happened. I said, Frank, do you mean I should go down there and tell them I stole this money that they had to pay back? I said, they'll throw me in jail. I can still hear Frank say, so what? He said, do you want to live or you want to die? It was as simple as that. Well, I get up the next morning and kiss my wife and two kids fondly farewell. I get down to Spring Street, and I'm a shy guy anyway, and I had to take 5 trips around the block. But finally, when I went into the bonding company and they showed me into this office, I was all steamed up, and I walked in this office, and I said, my name is Clip Walker. I'm an alcoholic. The little guy sitting there, he says, well, that's too bad. I said, I got drunk, and I told him the story. I spent this money, and you had to pay it back, and I said, I'm ready for jail. He kind of grinned. He said, well, sit down for a while, and let's talk it over. Pretty soon he said, you know, Mr. Walker, you're not the only guy that ever got in trouble with bonding companies. A lot of guys do. A lot of them for the same reason you're in trouble. He said, here's one. He pulls out a card. He said, this guy got in real trouble. He owes us $45,000. And you know at the rate he is paying us back, we figure it'll take about 980 years to get our money. He said, if we put you in jail, we couldn't collect a dime from you. I said, he said, how much could you pay us a week in good faith? I said, well, I get $18 a week Social Security. And I named off all these debts. And I said, also, I've got a wife and 2 kids and a dog and a parakeet to feed. He said, that's pretty heavy. He said, well, look, he said, could you pay us 50 cents a week in good faith? I said, well, sure. I can do that. He said, well, you do that and you'll be all right. When I walk out, he said, now, if you get in trouble and can't pay the 50 cents, just call us. You know, when I walked in there, I was still the defiant rebel. I was sure this SOB was going to throw me in jail. I was only doing this because Frank said so. But I got to thinking, well, gee, maybe there's something to this program. Facing up to things, being honest. Now, that was a wonderful little guy, and I thought, well, my cynicism came back a little. Well, maybe he was just an extra special kind of guy. Maybe I better try another one or two before I go off half-cocked. Well, near where I lived on San Vicente and Melrose, there was a Jewish grocer that I absolutely hated. I despised him. I had the deepest resentment of all towards this little Jewish grocer. You know why? Not because he was a Jew. Because I owed him $200 for groceries. And I couldn't pay it back. In my mind, I'd go like this. Well, he's putting a squeeze on me. He's going to run me out of town. He's going to garnish my wages. And I wasn't even working. And the guy never bothered me. But I said, boy, if it'll work with this guy, it'll work with anybody. So while I'm steamed up, I drive out to San Vicente and Melrose, and I go into this grocery store, and I finally get this little Jew aside. And I said, Mr. So-and-so, you probably don't know this, but I am an alcoholic. He says, you're telling me. I said, I owe you quite a bit of money. I lost my job from drinking. But I want you to know I recognize the debt. And I'm going to pay you back someday if you'll just go along with me. You know what that little Jew did? He put his arm around my shoulder and he said, Mr. Walker, I think you're wonderful. You're wonderful. He says, you know, when most people owe me money and they can't pay, they move away or they evade me. But you come in here like a man and you look me in the eye and say you're a drunkard. He says, that's the finest thing that ever happened to me. Well, I really broke down and I told him what we're trying to do. There were only a handful of us. We didn't know if it would work, but it was our only chance to survive. And he was enthralled with it. And as I started to walk away, he called me back and he said, Mr. Walker, he says, this is depression days. You're going to have a rough road back. I want you to know you don't have to worry about the money you owe me. And if you need food to feed your kids and family, you come in here. With me, your credit is unlimited. When I walked out on the sidewalk, that day. I would like to describe it, but I can't. I'm beginning now, I guess the program is beginning to work through my own actions. But one of the greatest lessons I learned that day was probably the greatest lesson of my AA life. You know what it is? How to master resentment. You know what Bill says about resentment? It probably kills more alcoholics, and that includes AAs, than any other one thing. That the harms people do us, whether they are imaginary or real, have the same power to destroy us. This little Jewish grocer had never harmed me, but in my mind, he had. If I hadn't gone to him that day, and he hadn't received me the way he did, I'm quite sure I wouldn't be here today. I owe a great part of my life to this little Jewish grocer. Well, we went to all our debts the same, all these hard, cold finance companies. I wasn't always received that well, but you found out that they would rather have something than nothing. And we were paying off our bills. 10-15 cents on bills were running into the hundreds. It took us 5 years to pay off. But all this time, I'm going down to meetings. That time, I'm wondering when I'm going to have my spiritual experience. The old book, you know, says after having had a spiritual experience, we practiced and we carried this message to others. And I'd read about Bill's experience. God, that was a wonderful one. That's the kind I wanted. A spectacular in color. The room lighting up, you know. And I'd ask him, when's the bell going to ring? When am I going to have my spiritual experience? And nothing happened. I don't know how long a time went by, but one day I'm in my room and I'm taking my 10th and 11th. And I'm praying because the book says to pray and meditate, and I'm still feeling like a hypocrite. but all of a sudden a thought struck me. I've been sober 2 years. Not only that, I hadn't even had a desire to drink for over a year. I'd even quit dreaming about getting drunk. Also, I realized suddenly that I had changed. The old fears were leaving me. I'd even had enough courage the Friday night before to get up and read the 12 steps. It took me 2 years to get that kind of courage. I was getting along better with people. Then I knew somehow I had made a change that I couldn't have done myself. And I sensed that I had had help from something bigger than I. And all of a sudden, I came to believe. Nothing spectacular. But I felt the presence of something bigger than I. God, as I understand it. I think my own responsive conscience and God consciousness finally merged. He was there all the time, of course. William James calls that the garden variety of spiritual experience, slow growth and awakening. It wasn't spectacular, but I wouldn't trade that experience for all the spectaculars in the world. Because mine was born of work and my own experience, and my conviction born of experience. And it stood me by these many years, and I've built upon it. And God's there, I think, all the time. Even though a lot of us will call our steps psychological. Reminds me of the old timer there in Whittier one night. He got up and, you know, he's a rough, tough old guy. He says, you know, I get sick and tired of these guys getting up here and say they can't find God. He says, you want to know something? He ain't lost. That's the way it was. He was there all the time. And I told my newfound friend, gee, you've got all the requirements to find permanent sobriety. Just be open-minded and willing. Forget your prejudice. Don't let the terms here upset you. Go to work and do what I did with this desire to quit drinking. And you keep on practicing these steps every day, whether you like them or understand them. Don't make any difference. You practice them long enough, someday something will happen to you. Something wonderful will happen to you. And your life will change like mine. And you will come to believe. You know, I thank God that the founders, when they wrote that step, second step, they didn't put a time limit on it. My God, I wouldn't be here if they'd put a time limit on it. Some guys, it takes a long time. But it's been a wonderful experience. You know, back in 1955, at the spiritual meeting in St. Louis, our lovable Dr. Sam Shoemaker talked. He is dead now, but he was one of the greatest friends that we ever had, Episcopal minister. This morning he said, you know, he said, the greatest needs of our time, I think, is a worldwide spiritual awakening. And he says, I am convinced that this may be upon us now, when I stand here and see you AAs and your program. I think this may be the start. He says, no one can doubt that God made what AA what it is, inspired it, gave it this intangible but unmistakable spirit. You know, our Father Gene yesterday said we should pass our program on to others, which we can do indirectly by example. We can't, of course, take on the troubles of the world with 30 million alcoholics yet that don't know about us. But by example, I think we can. And I don't know why it is at this time, at this point of history, God decided to help us drunks. You know, for countless ages, legions of drunks have gone on to oblivion without help. Maybe it's because God wanted to start this worldwide spiritual experience. I don't know. But if so, it wouldn't be the first time in history that God has used human weakness to demonstrate his healing power. All of you have heard of St. Paul. Who was he? He used to be Saul, the persecutor of Christians. He stood by and watched young Stephen stoned to death and never said a word. But one day God caught up with him and changed him. And Saul, the persecutor, became St. Paul, the apostle, a great Christian leader. Back in the 4th century, there was a young man who spent his life in drinking and rioting named Augustine. And he almost broke his mother's heart because of his drunkenness. And I have a hunch Augustine might have been a lush. But I think Augustine the lush finally hit bottom. And God caught up with him and changed him. And Augustine the dissolute became St. Augustine, one of the world's greatest Christian leaders. There's many more. But isn't it conceivable that God may be working through us today as an example to this very troubled, materialistic world? Could he have picked anybody who in the eyes of society are more forlorn and hopeless? We were the children of the darkness, weren't we? You know, I think that every AA story of recovery has a tremendous example to set before this troubled world. And the lesson, I think, would be this: that God can and does use human weakness or to demonstrate his healing power. No failure ever need be final. No man need to stay the way he is. With God's help, he can throw off the chains of any enslaving obsession and one day be free again to be just what God wants him to be. Thank you.